You're listening to The Sound Atlas by Russell Brooks.
Again. So, tell me about Matt Martin.
Matt Martin is a beautiful human being.
He's good looking.
He's good looking.
He's available.
He's a talented musician and painter.
Shoot.
He prints his own t-shirts.
How many?
He printed us like 10.
Weird culture, it's my life. I can't think to find time. What's the point of getting right? You're all alone inside a lot.
I am sitting here with Mr. Chris Rutledge.
Hello.
Thank you very much for coming, by the way.
You know, when Ricky Gervais, whenever he introduces Stephen Merchant, he just,
hello.
Right.
That's what I was going for.
I got you. It was close.
Yeah. I'm more like Carl Pilkington, unfortunately.
Oh.
I like to think.
Bald, round-headed man.
Yep.
Let's start with, where were you born?
I was born in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City.
Right.
The hippest place, the L.A. of the South, as they've been calling it these days.
Right. And how old were you when you first, not got into music, but first decided that you wanted to play music?
Well, I would say the first band that really taught me how to love music, what like in the way that I would come to love it, was the Beatles.
Okay.
And I got into them pretty hard when I was a teenager, and I got dumped by this girl, started smoking the marijuana,
right?
You know, and yeah. Started hanging out with my musician friends a lot, and they taught me how to play the bass guitar, and that was all I played for about 6 or 7 years was the bass, which most people in town have probably never seen me play the bass,
right?
And so,
but you started on bass, though.
That's what I started on for years.
Now, did you have family members that played music?
My dad played guitar, not very much. Okay. I don't think he like wrote songs or.
He have a guitar at home though.
Yeah, or? He did. Okay. He always encouraged me to play it, and I never wanted to.
Right.
But the guy that did teach me was actually a left-handed musician, and he taught me on a left-handed bass, and I'm right-handed actually. And I play my guitar left-handed.
Because of that,
yeah. I was just comfortable. I just started off that way. And then when I tried to make the switch, I mean, I'd only been playing for like a week, but it just felt so weird even after just a week of like working out my chops to try to turn around and play them a different way. So I gave up on that and just started playing left-handed, which everybody told me was a terrible idea. They're like, you're right-handed. Don't do this to yourself.
Right.
But And then I started playing the guitar. And
how old are you when you start playing guitar?
I think I was 20, maybe. And I, or 21. That doesn't quite line up with what I said before, does it?
Close enough.
You know, I mostly played bass for the first 7 years. I didn't really get serious about guitar until I was about 23 or 24. But, I would go over to my friends' houses, and none of them had left-handed guitars. So I just started picking them upside down.
Yeah.
And that's where I became the dude that plays an upside down backwards guitar in town. Right. Yeah.
As far as that goes, now, well, I guess we should probably preempt this with, when did you move to Bowling Green?
I moved to Bowling Green when I was, I think, 24.
Okay.
Maybe somewhere around then, maybe even 23, honestly.
And why did you move to Bowling Green?
I moved to Bowling Green because I had been pursuing a career in journalism, and you know, WKU, Western Kentucky University, is a pretty good school for journalism. And I applied and got some scholarships. And, you know, I wasn't really sure. I think every kid, like, your first instinct is to get as far away from home as possible. Bowling Green was only like 45 to an hour up the highway from Nashville.
Yeah.
But it ended up being the best decision I ever made, actually, I think. I mean, I love Bowling Green. Fuck Nashville. Am I allowed to say? Am I allowed to say the F word on this podcast?
You are. Yes.
Fuck Nashville. Bowling Green's my home.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is my place.
So you come up here basically for school,
yeah,
for journalism, and you've been here ever since.
Yeah, actually.
And when you come up here to, you're also writing, I guess, journalism as far as the journalistic side of things. What are you writing? Whom are you writing for?
At that point, I had started writing for American Songwriter magazine, who I still write for today a lot. And I think I got an internship with them in Nashville. So I did live in Nashville for about 4 or 5 months. Like after first moving to Bowling Green, like I went back and forth for that internship. But and then I was writing for the school and some online like publications, and yeah, I think Pace magazine, I got something published in them back in my college days about old Cage the Elephant.
Right.
You know, funny enough, when I moved to this town, I didn't know anybody but Cage the Elephant. Like, okay. I know that's like the opposite. Like most people move here and then they're going to meet the guys because they're around. But like they introduced me to everybody else, like Matt and Brad and Ryan Zumwalt, Zummy. They, that's how I met you guys. And that's how I met, pretty much all my best friends in
right
town. So,
you moved into town, and, when's the first time that you played music in front of people?
Well, that depends on what you mean. The first time I played music in front of my friends and they realized that I could sing and play songs was at right my friend Jeremy Simon's house.
Okay.
And actually, Jeremy, he fronted my favorite band. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're called Schools.
Right.
You were the guitar player in them, so
sure,
you've heard of them.
I have, yes.
I'm really, really good.
So that was
the
actually the
thing
first time you played in front of?
Well, that was the first time that I play around like my ex-girlfriend, like when we were, you know, still together back in the day, like we'd occasionally, but no, not really. I didn't really sing. I felt really insecure about my voice and really just felt insecure about music. I had played in like one or two bands at that point.
Okay.
The first band I was ever in was called Nightflower. We never had a show.
Nightflower.
And we were influenced by shitty hippie music.
Is that Bowling Green?
No, this was in California. I lived in California for...
Oh, we've skipped that. When were you in California?
I lived in California when I was like 17 to 19. I just kind of moved out there.
By yourself?
No, my mom actually, she moved out there for a job. And she was like, just come check it out. And yeah, I lived out there for about a year and a half.
Okay.
It was nice, but you know, I missed... the what do they call Southern hospitality? I'm
sure,
you know,
yeah.
The way people's relationships operate out there is just in a different level than.
So you moved to California. You're in Nightflower.
Yeah, I'm in this terrible band called Nightflower.
What do you play in Nightflower?
The bass. They kicked me out.
They kicked you out of Nightflower?
They kicked me and the drummer out one day. We actually had a practice, and we it was the best practice we'd ever had. We started working up a new song, uh-huh, and we wrote together. And our guitar player, he'd written all the songs up to that point, and it was kind of the rest of us working up the song, and him like, and then at the end of the practice, he just was kind of like,
he wasn't having that.
He wasn't happy,
yeah.
So he was like, I think me and Keenan, the other guy, is like, his name was Jazz, the guy that. That was his name.
Mm-hmm.
He made those like blues faces when he played, like, oh.
Like he's like, in pain.
Yeah, like he's in pain or like really has to go to the bathroom. When he's, you know.
All right, so you're in Nightflower. What's the second band?
Second band didn't have a name. None of these bands played shows, by the way.
Okay. So you never played in front of
people.
They
all just, well, occasionally people come watch us practice, but mostly, no. We just sat in the garage and plundered away for hours and then days and weeks and then quit. That was how.
Did you guys record anything?
The second band, we would occasionally do really lo-fi recordings at the house, but we didn't really, at that point, I wasn't really writing songs. I hadn't really tapped into what I'm good at musically. Like, music was like a weird journey for me because I think for a really long time, I wanted to be good, you know? Even though I told myself that that was bullshit and everybody told me that was bullshit, I think I really has like, man, if I'm going to create, I need to create to a certain standard. And then like, eventually I realized that that was stupid and like ridiculous. And that's like the best way to like stop a musician from like creating and moving forward, stop anyone, you know? It's just like this, mm-hmm, like feeling that, you know, I don't know, things are never going to work out the way they do in your head. So sometimes you just got to make stuff and then, you know, go from there. But
right,
it took me till I was 24 to learn that, I guess.
All right. So you So you play at Jeremy Simon's apartment.
Yep.
And then
and Jeremy said, "Hey, I love that song." So did Tiger. Hanging out with him. Tiger's of course, anyone in Bowling Green knows who Tiger is. There's only one Tiger.
I always have to clarify that. It's Tiger.
It's Tiger Merritt from the band Morning Teleportation.
Right.
And at the time, they were like, "Let's play a show." And my first show ever actually was just by myself, and I played a ukulele. I sang three songs that I'd written, and Tiger played lead guitar on the acoustic. Mm-hmm. And there was probably six people there, and it was at Tidballs. It was open mic. And so...
What song would you play?
Save Up All Your Kisses, John Denver's Head, and I can't remember the other one, honestly. Okay. One of my other tunes, or maybe a Neil Young cover. We always did those back in the day. That was kind of like the foundation of the cartoons originally. Mm-hmm. That is what that ended up being. Jeremy obviously enlisted his drummer, Dan, from Schools, Daniel Marlowe. And,
yes, sir.
It ended up being me, Jeremy, Dan, and Tiger, and we formed the cartoons. And our first show was, funny enough, about a month and a half after my first time ever playing on stage. And I was fronting a band. But to go back to what I was saying before about not having found my strength, I think my strength, I found it with the cartoons, which is arranging songs and writing songs. And I don't know, I never really had the opportunity to do that before and never really believed in myself to do that. I think mm-hmm. I just really needed some encouragement, and obviously that's what my friends gave me. So yeah. I really owe everything I have musically to your old band. That's what I'm trying to say. Basically, I would not be playing music if it weren't for Schools.
Well,
I say that with like 100% certainty.
That's very nice. But even as far as the, even as far as your first show at Tidballs, and you know, it was a super quick turnaround from not playing in front of people until being like, I'm the front man of this band.
Oh, yeah. It's a learning curve, too.
What did you learn?
Oh, wow. I learned you need to put the capo on the guitar before you start the first song. Because I definitely... We went to the first show, first song. We start playing the first song, and it sounds terrible. I mean, something is awful sounding about it. And we stop, and I kind of look back at everybody like a deer in the headlights. Like, what happened? We practiced. And there was one more person that was in the cartoons back then. He was kind of... in and out, but he did play our first show, and he later, of course, became our full-time guitar player, is Trey Bartley. And Trey said, "Well, Chris, your capo," and I looked down and I said, "Shit!"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I said, "Let's try this again." Took the capo off, put it on.
Yeah,
the crowd was really forgiving, man.
In a way, it's kind of the best to get that out of the way, though. I mean, you know, I messed this up, you know. Everybody here knows that. And the second time, it doesn't hold near as much weight. So, like, you've already kind of done, in a way, the silliest thing you can do. After that, it's just, do you like my music?
Yep.
Like, you're getting past all the, you know, the technical problems, so to speak. So, you're just basically building a foundation where it's just like, this is just me. And you have to introduce yourself, in my opinion, that way anytime you play. Regardless if I was in Schools or Double Zoo the Rabbit or anything, like you are building it, you're making you. And once you've did that, once you've went through the hiccups, it's the easiest job in the world. Because it's just like people either that like it or they don't. And you have no control over that. And I think that's just kind of what you come to understand.
Those are sage words. You know. I completely agree with you there, Russell. But, funny enough, the rest of that show, as I remember, it was pretty smooth.
Right.
It was like, it was just really that first little kerfuffle. Is that a word, kerfuffle?
I'll take it.
All right.
Yeah. Kerfuffle. Definition. Can I hear it in a sentence?
Oh, man. It was a kerfuffle when I forgot to put my capo on my guitar.
Country of origin. So let's go ahead and move on, though. What releases do the cartoons have out?
Well, our first record is called Empty in the Cup. We recorded it with Scott Gardner from the band Sleeper Agent and Waco Bell. I think Scott played, Jeremy played, Tiger played, Dan played, Trey played, and Lee Williams played as well.
So okay.
It was a kind of an all-star cast of
local
musicians.
Definitely, yeah.
Surrounding this dude that doesn't really know what he's doing. It worked out, though.
Regardless how you feel about yourself, I mean, that is an all-star cast.
It is.
It really is.
I think that was part of what helped me get on stage in the early days. Is I was like, no one's going to be looking at you. You've got all the most popular people in town surrounding you. You could.
Right. And you somehow, how did you do that? Well, what magic does Chris Rutledge hold in his back pocket that can say, hey, I've never played music in front of a single person before. Not really. But I'm going to have a band, and I'm going to take the best of everybody's thing.
Yeah, I think I just lucked out. But the journalism thing, though, you know, that I won't downplay that.
Sure.
I'd written stories about, like, pretty much every... When I was the music journalist in town, and I feel like there are still people in town trying to cover the local music, but when I was the local music journalist, every band got featured. Every person got talked to. Everyone got to represent themselves. I remember the first time Buffalo Rodeo played a show on campus, and they, you know, told me that they were obsessed with Kings of Leon and Arcade Fire, because, you know, their sound has gone through so many changes, but it's just funny, like, how they started and then what they ended up sounding like when they broke up, you know? It's like very different bands. But, you know, Rainbow Kitty Kitty, Schools, obviously. Man, who else was around back then? Let's just have, like, a, you know, in the hip hop albums when they, like, play a beat and then they're just like giving shout outs to people. I just want to shout some people out. Man.
Billy Swayze.
Yeah. Yeah. Billy Swayze's incredible. We were just talking about Billy earlier.
Yeah.
The Heavy Chase.
Yeah.
I liked Heavy Chase. They played with you guys a lot back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was just, well, kind of the Yellowberry crew at the moment, just because of the Sadler Connect and Micah Rigdon. And
I became friends with those dudes pretty quick, too, the Heavy Chase dudes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how Jared ended up playing in the cartoons. Okay. Because both of our bands kind of broke up at the same time, and we were in classes together, and we realized we both really liked the band They Might Be Giants.
Right.
So that was kind of, you know, how that was born. And now Jared's still in the band and has become like the McCartney to my Lennon, if I could be so presumptuous and awful as to make that comparison. Right. But no, you know,
actually, Jared had some very kind words for you.
I heard those.
Very kind.
He's being nice. You know, speaking of They Might Be Giants, there's this great part in the documentary where John Linnell is talking about John Flansburgh, and he says, I'm really just terrified that Flans is going to realize he doesn't really need me to do this band, like, at all. Like, this band would be just as good without
what
me.
What do you think are the best lyrics you ever wrote?
Oh, man. That's too hard. I can't answer that.
Yeah, you can.
No way.
Come on. All right. What do you think are... in the top 10 of the best lyrics you ever wrote?
Well, number nine, you know, there's like a couple songs that have lasted with me, like our song, the songs Race Dog and John Denver's Head from the first record. I'm still pretty proud of those songs. And You Were My Dreams Last Night. I mean, the lyrics are, you know, whatever. They're kind of there. I like them. But the song, I think that's still like, we got a lot of popularity just over that song, and that song got a lot of radio play, and sometimes that's how people, they're like, who are you? I'm like, I'm the You're in My Dreams Last Night guy on the radio, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was like my claim to fame for a couple of years. They still play it sometimes.
Well, let me ask you this, though. When you're writing lyrics, what do you tend to write about?
Well, the thing about writing lyrics is I've heard so many people describe it as so many different things, and I've experienced a lot of these things, but the most familiar one to me, the movie that I think really nails what it is to write songs is The Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story. That's exactly what it's like. I'm going through some trials and tribulations, and I'm having a hard time, and I'm like, walk hard.
Mm-hmm.
Walk hard. walk hard, and then I've got a song. That's exactly what it is. Usually I just have like an internal struggle in my brain, and I come to some revelation, and that is the song, basically. I don't know.
What is the best show you ever had?
Wow. Okay. There's three shows that come to mind, and I'll keep them all short. So the first show is we got to play the Exit in one time, sold out, opening for my friend's band, Jukebox the Ghost, who are like a pretty well-known band. And that show was just one of those shows where we got on stage and everything went right. And I was so nervous that it wouldn't, because we were playing for, that's easily the biggest crowd we've ever played for. And for me, coming from Nashville, I know I said fuck Nashville, but coming from Nashville, it's kind of a bucket list thing to do, to play the Exit in, much less the first time I ever played it, for it to be sold out.
Right.
I felt really blessed. And I think the whole band just had a lot of optimism, and it was just like a really good experience for everyone, which is really what makes the show. But on the other side of that, the music did sound very good that night, and people came up and tried to get our autographs afterwards, which was just the silliest thing that ever happened to me.
Still though,
it was great. I feel like honorable mentions, I got to mention that when we played, me and Tiger and Jeremy and Dan played this Valentine's show, and we butchered this Buddy Holly song. Jeremy forgot it in the middle of it, and we played Tom Petty's Girl on LSD, and I started dating my girlfriend that night, and I think that might have been the first night she ever sang with the band. Like, we invited her up to do Save Up All Your Kisses, and mm-hmm. I mean, that's like a milestone of my life right there. Like, me and Ramona have been together for over 5 years now, so
yeah.
She's been in the band. That was the night she joined the band, I guess, so yeah. That's a big show, but you know, it wasn't one of our best shows. But the other two shows, we recently played a spot called The Shack in Chicago, and it was the same kind of thing where everything just went right. The place was packed. People were passionate. I love Chicago. I love playing up there. And it just was like the best show. Like, I felt it was the best show we'd ever played, that show. And it was just a few months ago in Chicago. But my favorite show of all time, and this is kind of an infamous one, is the time that we played a Silver Juice tribute set with Bob from the Silver Jews and Pavement. He was opening for us, and he brought out David, the lead singer and songwriter and mastermind behind the Silver Jews, to watch our set. So I ended up playing Silver Jews songs for David Berman. Wow. That was probably the best experience of my life.
And what did he say? What did David say?
He said that we did a better version of Rebel Jew than they do, and that that we were really good. It was kind of funny. He was kind of like, you know, surprised that I had such a great band, because it was me, Kale, Jared, and Dan, which is the current band, and Ramona. And he's like, you know, I figure if you play Silver Jews music, that's because you don't really know how to play music, but you guys were actually really good. That was kind of his response. So
nice. Let me ask you this. If you could go back to your first show, any advice for you then?
I don't think there's any I could have taken at the time. You know what I mean? Keep doing what you're doing, and keep these people around you, because they're good people. They're your friends.
Right.
Still love all those dudes. It's funny. It's like almost like a brotherhood with the schools dudes and the morning telly dudes, especially Tiger. You know, Travis is my friend too. But like, you know, me and Tiger and Jeremy and Dan just spent so much time together. I feel like I'd do anything. Matt Martin, I'd do anything for any of those people anytime.
Well, Matt's so good looking.
Matt's a beautiful, beautiful man.
Guys, if you haven't checked that out, I'll try to plug in the Facebook link here. But
Matt Martin
is insanely attractive.
He is. And he's just such a sweetheart too.
Oh, he is a good dude. He's a great dude.
He's the best.
He's
dude.
Better than all of us.
Fact, he half of my gear I just borrow from him. I don't even buy it. I just borrow it from him.
This attractive man.
That's not why I'm saying all these nice things about him.
This attractive fella that's letting just paying everybody's way through life, looking good, being nice. Ladies. I mean, What's the holdup?
Matt Martin, a true Renaissance man. It's like a commercial. We should just like film a commercial,
a picture,
and like put it in.
Matt Martin, Renaissance man. No, I'm sorry. Matt is a good dude.
Yeah, though. Anytime I can like talk Matt about a lot. I love Matt. Matt's the best.
Well, last but not least, let me ask you this. Worst show you ever had?
Oh, wow. I mean, that Valentine's show didn't go well, but it was so fun. Let me think about that for a second. Oh, I know the answer immediately, actually. One time we played at the end, the same place that we played that Silver Juice set, and we borrowed some gear from somebody. And I think the guy they have there now, I think his name's Joseph Gosnell, if he's still out there doing the sound, plays in that band Bronzy Blonde. He did an incredible job. I don't know if he was there the first time we played, but the sound was very harsh. It was screeching at me pretty much constantly. And in the middle of one of the songs, Jared's amp, which he'd borrowed from another person, was an expensive vintage Fender, which was sitting up on top of something, fell off and just hit the ground. And we just stopped playing in the middle of the song because, like, what else were we going to do at that point?
Right.
And it was... I think Trey said he wanted to like crawl under a rock and die, like to me on stage. Like,
right.
He's just like, I want to crawl under a rock and die right now.
Right. How do you see yourself?
Wow. Well, that's hard because I have so much insecurity and so much like confidence issues. I think sometimes I see myself as like a loser.
Well, that kind of leads into my ultimate ending point of this. How do you see yourself when you're playing?
I think I see myself as loser done good. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think that was part of my thing about schools. Not to say that.
So is it a retribution thing?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, schools, that was kind of my feeling about that band was like one for the losers, you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know, not that you're, I mean, I think Jeremy encapsulates that better than anybody, but you know, it's just kind of like one for the weird kids as kind of like what I saw schools as, and I try to be that. I think that's what the vacuum that I want the cartoons to fill in people's mind is just kind of like weird kids doing weird stuff.
And when you're on stage, what do you look at?
Well, I look at the microphone a lot.
Sure.
I look at the backs of my eyelids a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the sky a lot. And sometimes I look at my friends in the crowd and I make eye contact. And
just long enough to get back to closing the eyes.
It makes me feel better. Right. You know, seeing my friends out there, that's been the best. I think we don't really have fans. Even though people come to our shows, I think we have like friends at this point. Like, and I think that can be like somebody sees you and they create a mystique in their mind about you, and they're going to do you better justice than you're going to do you in a conversation. You know, like the person that person in the crowd's going to invent is going to be way cooler than the dude on stage.
Way cooler than you will ever be. Right?
And I should just accept that and kind of, you know, base my interactions on that, but I don't. I always find the people that have come to our shows, and I say, thank you for coming to our shows. Thanks for listening to my music. And I generally form friendships with most of the people that come to our shows over and over again. So if we ever get really popular, it might be hard to keep that feed up. But fortunately, that's never going to happen.
However negative he may be, which is like Bill Cosby would say things. However negative he may be, thank you very much, sir. Chris Rutledge, thank you for your time. Thank you very much for being on the show.
God bless America. God bless schools. Fuck Trump. I'm out.
Thanks, man.